When it comes to compact construction equipment, Takuchi is a globally trusted brand. The famous red and grey machines you see everywhere are built to perform on any site, delivering power, precision, comfort and reliability from 1 to 15 tons. Now offering a lineup of proven compact track loaders, versatile tool carriers for construction and highways. Choose machines that work as hard as you do. Visit Takuchi-mfg.co.uk to find out more.
It's Thursday, the 27th of November, 2025, and this is Reconstruction with David Taylor and Phil Bishop, reviewing the latest news from the UK construction industry. And the reason we're podcasting on a Thursday is that Rachel Reeves would insist on delivering her budget speech at the same time as our usual Wednesday recording session, meaning that we couldn't react to her speech in time. Although actually, Phil, I noticed that the Office for Budget Responsibility tried to help us out by leaking all the information early. We could have done it.
Not early enough, though, unfortunately.
Not early enough, no, unfortunately. So, well, there's a lot to talk about in the budget.
It's not just the budget. There's actually been masses going on. I was thinking, after a rather quiet summer news-wise in the construction industry, we've had a pretty busy past couple of weeks. I mean, there's some big announcements we're not even going to talk about today, like Heathrow Airport decision and things like that. I mean, if you want to know anything that we're not talking about, just go to the Construction Index website and see what we've been covering for the past couple of weeks or month or so. There's masses going on. Before we get into the main business of the day, have you seen, David, what this guy, Thomas Heatherwick, the Garden Bridge man, has come up with now?
Yes, I have. The pictures are astonishing. It's possibly the ugliest building I've ever seen in my life. I mean, it's not a real building yet. These are just drawings. This is a new Birmingham City football stadium, isn't it?
Yeah, it's more than drawings. So the images they put out, CGIs. I mean,
exactly. That's what I meant. Yeah, but
you're not a fan.
No, I think it's the most bonkers looking building I've ever seen.
Describe it for those who haven't seen it.
Well, it looks. I suppose the main structure looks a bit like a stadium, which is what it is. I mean, I think it's 65,000 seat stadium, but it is surrounded by 12 massive brick towers. It looks a little bit like a Battersea Power Station gone mad. Only, you know, instead of being rendered brick, they're just sort of, they're supposed to look industrial, I think. They're supposed to hark back to Birmingham's industrial past. 12 massive brick towers, but they're about
Well, they're chimney stacks. They're chimney stacks. They're round.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. It just doesn't, I mean, I can't see, I don't know, I'm almost speechless, really, because it's just, I cannot imagine what was going on in the designer's head. As you say, it's Thomas Heatherwick who did he did that B of the Bang thing in Manchester, didn't he, for the Commonwealth Games?
It was lots of metal spikes all fell off.
Yeah, a really uncomfortable looking sculpture which proceeded to fall apart as soon as it was put together. Had to be demolished a year or two later because it was considered to be dangerous. What else did he do? Oh, yeah, the Garden Bridge. You mentioned the Garden Bridge, which never took off over the Thames.
Also a balmy idea. I know some people loved it, but a bridge is a mode of transport. It wasn't a mode of transport. Yeah. It was just a sculpture.
Yes, yeah, exactly. So that fell by the wayside. But, yeah, other people behind it. It's Stephen Knight, the chap who wrote Peaky Blinders, which is something I've never actually watched. So I don't
know. Oh, you should. It's wonderful.
Is it good? He did Who Wants to Be a Millionaire as well, didn't he? I've watched that.
Did he?
I think he did. Was he? Or maybe I'm getting confused with somebody else. He's produced all sorts of programmes and films on TV.
But he also did the Rogue Heroes SAS Rogue Heroes.
Oh, yeah. I did watch a bit of that. I watched a bit of the first episode. Absolute box. I really didn't like it, so I might give Peaky Blinders a miss as well. But no, so
everything he does, everything Stephen Knight does, is incredibly stylized. He also did House of Guinness, which I've seen and enjoyed. I mean, it's nonsense, but it's enjoyable nonsense.
Yeah,
and I mean, putting together these sort of creative minds and coming up with, the two tallest of these chimneys at either end, there are 12 of them in with different heights, but the two tall ones at the ends are 120 metres high.
Which is, yeah, ridiculous.
Looking at it, it's about three times the height of the actual stadium roof.
Yeah.
It is balmy, but I mean... So many stadiums are, I mean, apart from, you know, they do get occasional really interesting odd stadiums, like the Bird's Nest in, was that the
Beijing? Oh, in Beijing. Well? That was in Beijing. That was designed by the same architect, I think. David Manicker. I've got down in my notes, he did the O2 Arena, Wembley Stadium, and the Beijing National Stadium. And I think that might be the... That might be the Bird's Nest.
Right.
It might be. I might be wrong there.
Because he was with HOK when he did all of that.
That's right, yeah.
I may be completely wrong here, but my suspicion is that Heatherwick and Knight came up with this chimney idea and then had to bring in an architect to actually tie it together and make it work.
Well, I'm not sure an architect can make it work. It'll need an engineer and a contractor.
Yes, yes.
But I noticed that these are not just simply decorative. I mean, the term decorative is arguable, but they also fulfil a structural function because they've got cables extending from these chimneys to support the roof of the stadium, which I think is entirely wrong, because chimneys don't do that. Chimneys are freestanding. They don't hold things up. And these cables coming off the sides of these chimneys looks entirely wrong to me. I think the whole thing is completely mad.
Well, presumably they're anchored into the ground rather more than a factory chimney would be.
As I said, somebody like Arup will come along and make it work, but I still think it looks ridiculous.
Anyway,
an interesting idea. It'll probably prove, because it's so distinctive, it might actually work in its favour and people will love it. Like so many sort of attempts at public art, you know, love it or hate it, you know, it makes an impression and that usually helps it succeed.
Yeah. Well, anyway. Should we get on to the main agenda of today's meeting, which is, of course, the budget. And I had as always, we get so many emails from everyone and his sister wanting to comment on what they think of it. And various people said, oh, not much in it for construction. Actually, there is, like it or not, there are masses of different aspects which one could talk about from a construction viewpoint, from the raising of the minimum wage, which is a big deal. I think the most front and centre good news is the scrapping of the proposed landfill tax reforms. Now, you ran a really good piece earlier this year in the Construction Index magazine, written by Mark Smoulian, I believe. Really went to town on what the plans which the government put out to consultation earlier this year, what they meant. And the proposal was to abolish the lower rate of landfill tax, which is...
That's for inert waste.
Inert waste, £4 a tonne. And everything would just go to the top rate of £126 per tonne, which is a huge, huge leap.
3,000% increase, yeah.
And you think, well, you know, waste is a bad thing. Obviously, we want to discourage it. What it would actually do is that would just make fly tipping and illegal dumping even more widespread than it already is.
Yeah. We had that story just last week, didn't we, of that massive illegal dump in Oxfordshire.
Yeah.
Did you see that? I don't think that was construction waste, but
It wasn't, but it's all part of it.
But yeah, yeah.
But the House Builders Federation said it was the average cost of a new build home would have to go up by £15,000 just because of this one measure.
Yeah.
It would add £437 million to the ballooning HS2 bill. Well, you might say, given HS2...
Drop in the ocean.
Barely blink that. But anyway, £437 million for one project. And someone also mentioned a figure of £1.3 billion to the cost of development projects in London, just from this one proposal.
Mm.
Now, unusually, the government have sort of taken on board, and they've published the responses to their consultations, and everyone basically said it's too much to swallow, too expensive, it's going to have a too big an impact. Your whole government policy is try and get people to build. You want the private sector to build. And this is just another tie to bind house builders, which would slow down, prevent, disincentivize projects. And so they've ditched it. I mean, it's still going to go up, landfill tax, but not in the way it was. So that is clearly good news.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, also, I think there was... I get the feeling that the proposals really were just a way of generating revenue. There was no... I don't really think there was any serious environmental aspect to it. It didn't look like that to me. And it mitigated so badly against the economics of construction and house building and all the rest of it that it clearly didn't add up at all. So I'm not surprised they dropped it. I was rather surprised that they suggested it in the first place. But
since the landfill tax was introduced, it did play a huge part in driving recycling rates and reducing waste in the construction industry. It has been a hugely successful policy.
Yeah.
But there comes a point where you can go, we can always go further, but it's the law of diminishing returns, and each little extra bit costs more, is harder, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. So we've got the big win, and if you want to move it further forward, it gets harder and harder and harder. And they were planning on charging, you know, virtually banning landfill, in effect, taxing it out of existence, which is a whole different... a whole different policy and approach to things, which we're not ready for.
No, that's absolutely true. No, I think that was probably widely welcomed by people in the industry. But there are lots of measures introduced in this budget, which I don't know. Some people liked and other people didn't. I mean, you mentioned the minimum wage. Well, a lot of people bridled at that because it comes after the increase in employers' national insurance contributions and all the rest of it just makes employing people even more expensive. So a lot of people didn't like that. What else?
Oh. But do you know what, though? What they're doing by increasing the minimum wage is because the lowest rate of paying of income tax, £12,570 a year, it's basically getting anyone who works is in that. And it's, I mean, even people on a state pension very shortly, I think, will have to pay income tax, which they didn't have to do before. The thresholds, the bands at which you pay different levels of income tax were fixed by, I think it's by Rishi Sunak in 2022. And now they're going to stay in place until at least 2029. So that's 7 years of the threshold saying, which means anytime you get a pay rise, which, you know... wage inflation has gone up a lot and it's continued to go up. More and more people are being caught into that. And it used to be, if you're in the 40% bracket earning more than 50 grand a year, you were considered well-heeled and proper middle class. Not anymore.
I mean, of course, we did know that there would be some sort of increase in taxes, and I suppose this is a sort of a subtle way of doing it rather than actually increasing the rate of income tax or VAT, but to freeze the threshold is a quite clever way of doing it. We're not changing anything, you know.
Well, it means that on paper she can say that she, being Rachel Reeves, the Chancellor, has adhered to the manifesto commitment not to raise the rate of tax. But I mean, one of the comments I heard, my overall takeaway from the budget, one MP was saying it was tactical rather than strategic. And I think it's a good description because, yes, there's a black hole. She had to raise taxes. But she's increasing the benefit bill, which is supposed to be a tightening of the benefit. I mean, the benefit bill's just got out of control. Yeah. And some pressure from backbench MPs, which is... removed the two-child universal credit benefit cap, which not that long ago, MPs who wanted to do that lost the Labour whip.
I'd forgotten about that.
They were bad people. You're not allowed to even mention that. And now she's gone and done it. So, I mean, that's clearly tactical. The whole strategy of the government is to promote growth and encourage business, blah, blah, blah. But everything they've done is basically anti-business. And the only thing they're doing to promote growth is changing the planning laws. They're not... There's a perfectly respectable economic argument that says spend public money on infrastructure that can generate growth.
Yes.
They're not doing that. They're looking to the private sector to spend all the money and the private sector. But at the same time as wanting the private sector to do the money, they're adding on costs and regulation. And to be fair, a lot of these regulations predate the Labour government, including the building safety regulator and all that regime, and the developer's tax for cladding remediation and all of that that's been delayed but is coming in next year. So this is not just Starmer and Reeves that are doing this. It's been governments of recent years.
Yeah,
they're putting more and more burdens on business and hoping that business will somehow thrive and get them out of the hole, purely by saying, yeah, you can build anything anywhere and you won't even need, well, you will need planning permission to build it by a railway station, but it'll be presumed to be yes.
If you can afford to do it.
And you can find any builders to do the work for you.
I mean, there are some things which I think, obviously we mentioned that scrapping of the landfill tax changes, but introducing free training for under 25 apprentices for SMEs, I think was a good thing to do. We've got a chronic skills shortage in the industry.
I'm not on top of that. I don't know how that works. I mean, you're still going to have to pay your CITB dues, I imagine.
Well, that's true.
It's entirely free.
Ah, good point, actually. Yeah, I don't know what they mean by free in that case.
No, I don't.
Let me see. It's a growth. I've got it written down here. £725 million growth and skills levy aimed at supporting apprenticeships for young people, including a change to fully fund SME apprenticeships for eligible people under 25.
So they're levying business. So they have, they're levying, putting another tax on business or increasing the apprentice levy or whatever it is, so that the young people can get free training, like they used to in the olden days, could go to university for free.
Yeah. Yeah,
the one that got me, and I think is disappointing, is the employee ownership trust capital. Gains in 2013, legislation came in, and this was Vince Cable when he was business secretary under the coalition, the Lib Dem side of the coalition. They introduced this that you could sell your business to an employee ownership trust and not pay capital gains tax on that. If you sell it to a competitor or whatever, you have to pay capital gains tax, which is whatever it is, 40%. And now, as of yesterday, I don't know when it actually comes in, or whether it comes in immediately or comes in next April or whatever, but the if you sell your business to an employee ownership trust, you only get 50% capital gains tax relief, which I think means you pay 20% instead of 40%. I'm not all over capital gains tax, but essentially it is a deterrent, an impediment to. I mean, there are still reasons to sell to an employee ownership trust. It still might be tax beneficial, but it's not as tax beneficial.
No.
So there'd be many potential sales to employee ownership trusts, I would guess, that will not now happen. Apparently, it's going to be a review of how to encourage and promote employee ownership and employee share ownership and so on. But, I mean, this is to save £900 million on this. But lifting the child benefit cap is costing, I can't remember the figure, £2 billion or £4 billion, £4 billion or something. So it's hitting business to pay for welfare. Now, I'm not saying we shouldn't have welfare, but that's tactical rather than strategic. If the whole thing is trying to promote business, it is clearly not promoting business. It's all moving in one direction.
I imagine that Rachel Reeves probably had a look at this EOT business and thought, what, they don't pay any tax on the sale? Well, we'll put a stop to that. I mean, it's an easy win for her, isn't it? You know, basically she can turn around and say, well, you get a 50% tax rebate on this sale, you know, so that's pretty generous.
But isn't it ironic? I mean, the two ways of looking at it, it's ironic that the it was the, okay, it's the Lib Dems that drove it, but it was a coalition led by the Tories government that introduced a measure to promote essentially, you know, cooperatives, employee-owned businesses, which you'd think would be a really sort of good, not exactly, well, yeah, socialist measure. And then a Labour government comes in and says, "Oh no, we can't have employees owning their own businesses. We're going to clamp down on that." But maybe it's, they don't, you know, they just don't like business. Full stop. No one's their own business.
Could be that. I don't know. I mean, they've been talking a lot of the things in this budget. I suppose have been these days. Budgets are pretty well flagged up beforehand anyway, notwithstanding OBR leaks. But the changes to the planning law and, you know, reducing environmental restrictions and stuff like that has been something that the government's been talking about ever since it got into power. It doesn't seem to have had much effect so far, as far as I can see. But I know that I got a press release from, who was it? It was a comment from CPRE, the Campaign for the Protection of Rural England, who said, you know, does that mean we're going to have nuclear power stations built in our national parks? Which is a bit of an overreaction, perhaps. But, you know,
it's a direction of travel.
It's a direction of travel. Yeah, their argument is that you know, we have to protect these precious environments because, you know, when they're gone, they're gone. You can't get them back. And so there's a lot of pushback, I think, from that lobby against liberalising the environmental regulations. So, but, the, you know, they've made no secret of the desire to do that, so I'm sure that's going to happen.
There's one other interesting announcement in the... I don't know what... I don't think Rachel Reeves specifically mentioned this in her speech to the House of Commons yesterday, but it's in the documents that the Treasury published immediately afterwards and the OBR published immediately before, which is that the Lower Thames Crossing is getting a final tranche of £891 million of public money to get it to the starting point for enabling works and up to the start of construction. But then that's it. Then it's over to the private sector. And the method they've decided on is a regulated asset-based model. I don't know why it's taken them so long to decide this. I mean, she could have announced this a long time ago. Mm. It says the project will be taken forward on this basis with formal market engagement launching in 2026. Well, they've been spent all year, the Treasury has, and the Department for Transport, looking at the... financing the Lower Thames Crossing and talking to people. Why they didn't start formal market engagement back in the spring, I've no idea. They could have started it. But apparently, formal market engagement launches in 2026.
What does that mean, formal market engagement? Not for the benefit of my ignorant listeners, but for me, because I don't really know what that means.
I couldn't tell you exactly what it was. My impression is it's a bit like publishing tender documents.
Right.
It's saying, here's the deal that we're offering.
Right.
Who wants it? Who's interested? Put your hand up. Let's have your bids in.
Well, I think in that case, the reason it's delayed is that they actually couldn't decide or agree internally how they were going to do this because, you know, as we've said many times on this podcast, you know, the Lower Thames Crossing, you know, what's the correct way forward to it? You had a good idea. You said they should just hand it over to the private sector and let them do it.
Well, that could yet happen. I mean, I think of how the Channel Tunnel happened, although that had a false start when Eurotunnel were going to build it. And Eurotunnel was a consortium of contractors. And then they realised that actually you need a client and a contractor as separate entities, rather than just letting them get on with it. And so they split Eurotunnel up and created TML, Transmanche Link, which was all the contractors in joint venture, 5 French and 5 British. And Eurotunnel was the client body, the money people. But the construction industry had been hugely involved in the, you know, creation of Eurotunnel, the client side at the beginning. Now, it seems to me that kind of a model could work here, which would still follow the regulated asset-based model. And everything I've
I mean, the piece I wrote for you, for the magazine, whatever it was, 6 months ago, 8 months ago, I think still stands. I think the, because if they create a, I mean, the regulated asset-based model we saw on Thames Tideway, saw the Sizewell, you know, it works well. Thames Tideway is a, it's actually Basel Jet Finance, is a listed entity in which people can, it sells bonds and shares and whatever. It's a financial vehicle which raises money. And it gets income from a levy on, I think it's just Thames water bills, and has done for some time, will continue to do so. Now, the model for Thames, for Lower Thames Crossing, is much cleaner and simpler even, because there is already a toll charge at Dartford, a revenue stream there. And it seems to me you simply say to the private sector, OK, you now own and operate the Dartford Tunnel, and you own and will operate the Lower Thames Crossing. You've got your revenue stream. There you go. And you're, today it's whatever it is. And I had the figure in the big piece I wrote about then. I can't remember what it was. But how many millions of pounds a year you get from Dartford. And you know that from the date you complete the Lower Thames Crossing, you will... You don't know, because you don't know what the traffic forecasts are, but you can forecast, you know, there's going to be traffic through it, assuming there is. You know there's going to be some, you know, revenue from that, and that's all yours for however they set it up, 25 years. And they could cap it like they did with the Dartford Bridge and say, once you've got your money back in 25 years' time, we're not going to have any more tolls on it. And then you can renege on that like they did at the Dartford Bridge and double and triple the tolls and completely breach the covenants and the promises there. But it could be clean. But the question is, if a new client comes in who owns the project, will they oblige, should they be obliged to accept the contracts that National Highways has signed with Balfour Beatty, Skanska, Brieg and Murphy?
Why wouldn't they?
But it's not there. It's like you buying a house and saying, by the way, I'm having an extension built next door next year, and my mate's doing it, and this is the price that we're paying.
So good analogy.
You have to do that.
Okay.
No, if I'm buying the house, I want to pick my, you know, I want to choose whether to have an extension or not, and whether to, you know, who's going to build it. So I don't know how that's going to work. And the only way to avoid that, as I said repeatedly, is that the contractors have to get right up and front and centre and say, we're in charge.
Well, another 900 million into the pot, and we'll see what happens after that.
As a Kent resident who lives quite a long way away from it, I'm looking forward to it being built, to it having been built. I understand it would be hugely disruptive for people in North Kent. And I wouldn't, if it was on my doorstep, I probably wouldn't be keen either. But as a piece of traffic infrastructure, it's much needed. Two or three business stories we've reported on in the past week or so. Well, actually, just this week. And the one that really struck me, I talked about RSK before. RSK, it must have stood for something once. I don't know what it stood for.
I was just going to ask you what it stood for.
It might have been the people originally started. I don't. Anyway, RSK began life as a, and its root is in environmental engineering consultancy. And sort of branched out from that too. Into, you know, origins counting buttercups and birds, but moved into water engineering, civil engineering consultancy in a wider sense. And it has just been hugely, hugely acquisitive. It's gone up from something like, I don't know, 200 million to 2.2 billion tenfold in the past sort of 8 to 10 years or something off the top of my head. I do have in front of me that last year it turned over 2.24 billion. I can't remember how long ago it was turning over 100 or 200 million, but not that long. And it's done this largely by dozens and dozens and dozens of acquisitions, a lot of them quite small, and some of them really quite left field. It bought a PR company, a public relations company, for, at one point too, because it worked with them on, you know, consultation on infrastructure projects or something. You know, you're sort of basically in the infrastructure consultancy field, we'll buy you. And it's bought companies overseas. But it's still not strayed. I mean, Binny was a really big one that it bought a couple of years ago in the water industry, a big water engineer and consulting engineer. So that was a major leap for it. Mm. But it's all essentially weird add-ons notwithstanding. And garden nurseries.
Especially, yes, garden nurseries.
Garden nurseries it's bought. And it has had some niche contracting businesses. Steel fabrication, it's bought a steel fabrication mm-hmm. business. It's bought a drilling company. A drilling company you can sort of understand, because if they're doing, site investigations and ground studies, they can do it and, offer it the whole yes, package in-house, do the drilling. So they are sort of, involved in tier three, I guess, sort of contracting.
Flood protection and water engineering is a big part of it as well. Yeah. They've had several small companies in that sector, haven't they?
But this week, they announced that they've... has acquired, just checking whether they've announced it's going to happen or it has happened. It has happened. They have bought Octavius Infrastructure, which may not be a terribly familiar name, but that's the new name for what used to be Osborne Infrastructure, the rail and road building bit of the Geoffrey Osborne Group, which Osborne went into administration, if I remember right, last year or the year before. But shortly before it did, it was trying to sort of stay afloat, selling off bits, and it sold off its infrastructure bit to private equity owners. Octavius turned over 320-something million last year. Pre-tax profit, 8.6. So
it's grown quite quickly since...
Tidily profitable, tidily profitable business. Well, Octavius itself has bought a Scottish company. I can't remember. Who did Octavius buy not long ago?
I don't know. I mean, I think it's bought more than one company since it... was spun off.
Yeah, Octavius, it bought R&W Civil Engineering in 2023, Navitas Engineering the same year. And I'm sure it's bought someone bigger than that more recently, but it doesn't immediately come to my mind. But anyway, the fact that RSK has bought Octavius is... We can no longer call RSK even a consultancy conglomerate, which it kind of had become.
Yeah.
It is now a complete mixed bag. And conglomerates are out of fashion. And there have been cases of, contractors setting up consultancy businesses. I mean, there's, who is it? Vinci had Taylor Woodrow Laboratories, which is sort of a consultancy business. And other contractors have got sort of consultancy arms to them for design and build purposes or whatever. But essentially, the drift that there was a move to that when PFI came along and design and build and all of that, there was a move to people trying to be all things to all men. And I think there's generally been a move away from that. And that these days people prefer to keep it clean and say, are you a contractor or are you a consultant?
Yeah.
And this goes against that grain. And I've got to be honest, I'm not sure it works, but I'm not sure what else. There wasn't much left for RSK to buy. It's running out of things to buy because it has got to keep turnover growing to feed the beast. RSK is not an organisation that's interested in profit. It hasn't made a profit since 2017. It makes huge losses. I mean, its shareholders all managed to get money out of it, and they get their money back, so they're happy. But the actual bottom line pre-tax profit, if you make no profit, you pay no tax. You could say it's a really good business sense not to make a profit. But I'm not comfortable with the idea of businesses that don't make a profit.
I can understand not making a profit, but I can't understand just constantly making a loss. I mean, that just doesn't seem right to me. It feels uncomfortable. But
As long as you can feed the debt mountain, it doesn't matter whether the debt mountain gets bigger and bigger. I mean, there are Italian names for these sort of things. it's just getting bigger and bigger. And they say that's the plan. And if their shareholders are happy, their shareholders are happy. Job done.
Yeah, yeah. I can't get my head around it. But, I mean, you've quoted Alan Ryder as the founder of the business. Is he the chairman, chief executive? I don't know what his title is.
I think he might be executive chairman.
Yeah, yeah. But he's perfectly relaxed about this. He thinks it's fine. In fact, he says, you know, this is my business model, isn't it? That I don't need to make a profit. I can make a loss. And as you just said, as long as I can service the debt and keep my shareholders happy, everything's hunky-dory. Just doesn't sound right to me. I couldn't possibly live like that. Do you know what I mean?
Well, it depends how long you had to live.
Yeah.
If you knew you had 6 months to live, you'd hit that Barclay card like hell, wouldn't you?
Yeah, that's probably true.
I'm not suggesting that Alan Ryder is ill. He's got 100 years to live. I'm not for a moment suggesting that. He's living for the moment. And
you know, high risk, high reward. If you have an appetite for risk, that's the way to, you know, get filthy rich, isn't it? They always say.
Yeah.
I couldn't do it.
Well, I mean, just keep an eye on what RSK does. I mean, they seem to be buying somebody else every hour, well, probably once a month, I would say, on average. They snap somebody else up. So just wait and see who's next.
Yes. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if it's another contractor, because if they're in the tier one contracting business now, they'll want to be properly in it.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You know, really dive into it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, there's another deal you're quite keen to talk about.
Yes, well, this is one which I certainly didn't see coming, because I suppose really it's from the plant sector. Komatsu, as I'm sure all our listeners will know, is one of the biggest construction equipment manufacturers in the world, Japanese firm, number two, I think, after Caterpillar worldwide. And they are, you know, they're a good company. They've got a factory up in Berkeley, up in the northeast, which they've had for about 40 years now, and they do very well. They produce excellent equipment, and their products have been sold, I think, since even before they set up the factory. In fact, I think you told me this, that it goes back to the early 70s, that Komatsu established a distributorship in this country through another Japanese company, this sort of one of these big trading companies. I can't remember what they call them. They've got a funny name for them. They call them kaibols in Korea. They call them something else in Japan. But it's Marubeni is the name of the firm, big trading company. So Marubeni Komatsu has been selling Komatsu excavators and dumpers and all the other stuff that they make for years and years and years.
For as long as anyone in the industry can remember.
Yes, exactly. But not anymore, because we had an announcement this week that Marubeni is selling its dealership to an Irish outfit called McHale Plant Sales, which I'm ashamed to say I knew virtually nothing about. It. Even if I'd heard the name, it hadn't struck any chord. They're based in Dublin, but they've been in the UK for a few years now, because they I looked them up, and they represent Metso, which is either a Dutch or a Scandinavian manufacturer.
Scandi, aren't they? Metso, I think.
Yeah, something like that. They make mining equipment, very specialised.
I thought, aren't they crushing and screening? Isn't that?
Yeah, something like that. Oh well, yeah, right then, crushing and screening. Same thing. Nearly. but now they are, McHale is now the Komatsu dealer for the UK, and I assume for Ireland as well.
As of 1st of January,
yeah. Actually. Oh, yes, sorry, yet. Yes. Yeah, not quite yet. Yeah, which I thought was quite interesting, because it's quite didn't see that coming. It's quite a big change to the sector. You know, the big plant manufacturers have their dedicated dealers. You know, JCB has Scott JCB and somebody else JCB, and they've got JCB dealers all over the country who are dedicated to them. They just sell their stuff. And of course, Caterpillar has got Finning. And Komatsu always had Marubeni Komatsu, but now it's somebody else. So that's, I think, what really leapt out at me.
I wonder how much, they're saying that all the existing service agreements and guarantees and warranties and whatever will all be observed and maintained. So as far as customers are concerned, nothing changes. But I wonder how much of the personnel will stay the same.
Yeah.
Whether you know, if you are a Komatsu customer, owner, it will look exactly the same. It'll just be a different name above the door. Or whether, you know, things will gradually change. And you will have
people
coming knocking on your door.
no sign of any change at the moment, because today, the very morning, you and I both, I think, received the same press release from HE Services, Kent-based, your local plant hire, in fact, I believe, Phil.
Indeed.
They're located quite close to you. That they've just placed their biggest order, I think maybe their biggest ever order for equipment. Just kind of find out how much it is worth. Bear with me a second. Just looking at the press release here. £25 million order they've just placed with Marubeni Komatsu for Komatsu equipment. And of course, the equipment won't be delivered next Monday. It's going to be phased over a period of time. But there's a nice quote there from the managing director of Marubeni Komatsu, a chap called Brian Graham, who says, "We're delighted to continue our long-standing relationship with HE Services. Their confidence in Komatsu reflects the strength of our machines, our support network, and our shared commitment to delivering quality and innovation to customers across the UK." I mean, did Brian say that and then shut up shop and go home? I don't know. I imagine that he'll probably have some role to play, maybe, in McHale. He knows the customers, presumably. He knows the product.
But Marubeni Komatsu is a good outfit. You know, Komatsu machines are highly regarded.
Yeah.
In this country and worldwide, and as I understand it, are well looked at, you know, are well supported by mm-hmm. the dealer, which obviously is what makes it such an appealing acquisition for McHale plant sales. It's not buying a basket case that's got to go in and sort out. So one can't imagine that McHale would want to do too much different, because you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. However, the latest accounts that we've seen from Marubeni Komatsu, which for the year to March 2024, showed a 22% fall in turnover from 213 to 167 million in mm-hmm. 1 year.
Yeah.
Which, okay, you get turnover from you know, parts and service and whatever, but essentially that has to reflect a fall in machine sales.
Yes.
And that was in the year to March 2024. I don't know what's happening in the year to March 2025 or what is happening in the current year. But if the trend is down, and you suggested it might be because of all the, you know, cheap Chinese machines coming.
Yes, that's right.
You can see how Marubeni, it might be less interesting to them when they've got, and Marubeni have just got interest in everything worldwide, almost literally, fingers in pies all over. To the extent that you go on the Marubeni website and I can't find mention of Komatsu or construction machinery. So
it's just a small component, UK, just a small part of it,
So it's diddly squat £200 million business, you know.
But by the way, I've just found that term that Marubeni, the Japanese term for this sort of massive trading company, is a Sogo Shosha.
One more time?
Sogo Shosha.
Sogo Shosha, okay.
Yeah, that's the Japanese term.
Right.
Yeah.
So that means trading company rather than conglomerate, does it?
I imagine so. I don't know. Maybe it's not a direct translation anyway. Right. But yeah, it's one of those. They seem to be uniquely sort of Southeast Asian, these big trading companies like Daewoo and...
Well, the one I think of...
Samsung.
The original one I think of is a British Southeast Asian trading company, Jardine Matheson.
Oh, yes.
Which is still involved with Gammon, with... Balfour Beatty.
Yes, that's right. Balfour Beatty joint venture.
Hong Kong.
Yes. Yeah.
I think they date themselves back to, are they something out of the South, it's called the East, not Southeast, East India Trading Company.
Oh, right, yeah.
Which basically ran half the world. Apparently, East India Trading Company was more powerful than the Queen Victoria and, you know, richer than Britain.
yeah. It was basically a government, wasn't it? Not just a company, yeah. Well, Marubeni is big. It's not that big, but it's big anyway. And
the other big plant. So moving on, the other big plant story of the week. Just this morning, VP, who I wish they were still called Vibroplant, even though they don't sell vibrating plant anymore. But VP just is a difficult VP, name, especially when it's big V, little P. Anyway, VP is parent company of various companies, including UK Forks and Ground Force, etc. Mm-hmm. And one of its companies is Brandon Hire Station. It acquired Brandon Hire Group in 2017 and merged it into its existing hire station tool business. And Brandon Hire Station has been having a
pretty rough time of it lately with the downturn in construction activity. But this is a familiar site. There's one near me. I drive past it from time to time. Yeah.
Well, I hired a vibrating compactor from one a few weeks ago. Is my local plant hirer.
Well, here's the story. They don't want you in anymore.
Ah.
They're not interested in your sort, David, and they're not interested in me either. The DIYer, the consumer, the retail offer, they're quitting that. They've got approximately 100 stores and they're shutting 60 of them and laying off 400. Well, they say they're laying off 400 people. I'm sure some of them will find jobs elsewhere in the group, but headcount is being reduced by 400. Well, actually, headcount being reduced by 400. 400 jobs are going, aren't they?
So, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, they're only going to keep 40 stores and they're going to service only contractors, accounts, what's the term they use, major customers, complex projects and specialist divisions. So, yeah, basically their own companies as well within the group that Brandon Hire Station will look after.
But interesting.
Essentially, they're pulling out of the bog standard tool hire market.
Yeah. And what is it, 'cause it's overcrowded, I assume?
I looked at their, this is in their half year statements, and they don't give separate results for Brandon in the half year statements, but in their last full year, whatever that would have been, year two, March or whatever, results, they wrote off tens of millions on Brandon Hire. So it was already doing, having problems last year.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah. I don't know whether it's just too much competition or whether it's just not as good as the other people at doing what it does.
That's interesting. Yeah, okay. Well, I was talking to the new boss of what used to be HSS, Tom Shorten. You know, we talked recently about how HSS was basically selling off all its assets, all its inventory and its depots and stuff like that. And its branches, and was going entirely online, and had this tie-up with Speedy, which is quite interesting. And I was speaking to the new managing director, Tom Shorten, who's been, I say new managing director, he's a managing director, or chief executive, I should say.
Of which bit? Because he's sort of been split in two.
Yeah, well, ProService Marketplace. In fact, I think the name is even a little bit more complicated than that. ProService Marketplace is basically what HSS is now. They've sold off their
That's the Uber bit rather than the Ocado bit rather than the Morrison bit.
Sorry, that's a good analogy. Yeah, sorry, I'm not expressing this particularly eloquently, but no, they sold off all their assets, the inventory and the depots and stuff to this private equity firm Endus LLP, and they'll run it as the hire service company, which ironically was what HSS was originally back in the 1950s.
So they're the shops. They're the shops. Bricks and Mortar is now the hire service company.
Yes, yeah.
Right.
And as you say, the Uber, or actually he made a comparison to the Amazon, is now ProService Marketplace, HSS ProService Marketplace.
I think Ocado might be nearer the mark.
Possibly, yeah. I was going to say, now he was saying that obviously they've got Speedy is now a major partner. It's taken a 10% interest in HSS ProService Marketplace, but and Speedy will be the main supplier of inventory for ProService customers. ProService in return will also handle rehire for Speedy. But ProService has...
Sorry, you were talking to the ProService man.
Yes, I was. Right. Yes, Tom Shorten, yeah. But ProService deals with other firms as well, including well-known names such as Sunbelt and VP, indeed. And so they will help to sort of, if you like, consolidate from various different suppliers. And he said that we will work and are already working with lots of small independent regional plant hirers. So, you know, they can... Their customers can order through ProService, and similarly, ProService customers can order locally from small independents using the ProService platform.
Okay, so that is more like Amazon than Ocado.
It is. It is. And the good thing, I think the good thing about that is that it gives another string to the small independence bow, if you like. They've got a big partner here who's helping them, and it's a sort of a two-way street, I suppose, that they help each other. They provide a local service on the ground for pro-service customers, but pro-service will feed them customers as well.
At a cost. I'm not quite sure how much, you know, the little local takeaways appreciate Just Eat and the other ones.
Well,
I mean, presumably the independent tool hire will be paying pro-service a chunk of its profits.
Oh, I imagine so. But, you know, it might help with cash flow, which, of course, is important.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I used to, when, as a DIYer, and of course I can only speak like you, I can only speak as a DIYer. I've never been a professional in the plant hire sector or in construction at all, really. I always used to go to my local independent plant hire in South Moulton in Devon, who packed up shop. You know, he got to a certain age and he thought, I don't want to do this anymore. And like any small business, decided he was going to just shut up shop and that was it. And so I can't go to him anymore. So I've been going to Brandon if I wanted a, you know, a compactor or a concrete mixer or anything like that. Don't know where I'm going to go now.
I can see you can't go there anymore. So if anyone wants to open a tool hire shop in North Devon, there's a gap in the market.
It sounds like. No, there probably are people. I mean, I don't know. I don't do it often enough to know who the suppliers are, but they're out there. I know it.
Right, I think we're just about done. But I should ask, you've been talking to the chap from Pro Service, then. It sounds like you've got a big feature lined up on this in the next edition.
A feature?
Of Dutch and
Index
Magazine.
How big it's going to be. Exactly. Yeah, I had a chat with him yesterday. In fact, we both should have been listening to the Chancellor. We had a Teams meeting just for half an hour and ran through it, and it was interesting. So there will be something in the next issue of the magazine, which is out after Christmas. It seems a long time away, but it'll be with you in no time.
You mentioned Christmas. We should give a plug to the new edition of the Construction Monopoly board game.
Ah, yes.
That Construction Index has been involved with putting out. With if you bought the first edition as a gift for someone or for yourself, you may wish to buy the second edition to complete the collection. These are collector's items, particularly the tokens. It's not the boot and the top hat anymore. It's the digger and the dump truck, etc.
Yeah, yeah.
They've got different tokens, and I think different projects and companies involved in the new edition. But the big difference of the new edition of Construction Monopoly is in three languages. It's in French and German, as well as English, the one set.
Ah.
And so if you didn't buy the first edition, and you know you've got any friends who want to brush up on their French and German, or are French or German, or from one of those countries, there's a Christmas idea.
Yeah, excellent idea.
Anyway, Construction Index website has got it. Well, you just go to constructionedition.co.uk and see the Monopoly game there. But my and finally item for today, I don't want to talk about builder's licence idea anymore, because I've made it quite clear that despite what the Federation of Master Builders and an awful lot of people think is an absolute essential thing, you should have to have a licence to be allowed to do any building work in someone's home. The government has made it quite clear it's got no interest in it at all.
No.
There was a debate in the House of Commons on the 13th of November, initiated, I believe, by the Federation of Master Builders via Conservative MP Mark Garnier, who sounds like a Conservative MP with a small c Conservative reactionary wanting to put barriers up to trade rather than a free market, old-fashioned Burkean liberal free market type of Conservative, which other parts of the party might associate itself with. He wants the government to come up with a scheme of compulsory licensing for SME building firms working in the renovation and domestic improvement space, as per Federation of Master Building lobbying, it's been going on. And God bless her, Kate Dearden, the Minister for Employment Rights in the Department for Business and Trade, said, we're aware of schemes that exist in places like USA, Australia, New Zealand, but the available evidence suggests that while they can deliver some benefits, they also have detrimental effects, including increasing prices for consumer.
Yeah.
There's also no clear evidence that the existence of licensing schemes reduces the incidence of poor quality work.
Which is what I've been saying
all along. It's going to be a barrier to entry. It's going to make everything more expensive, and it ain't going to solve the problem that they think it's going to solve.
No. I mean, everybody with a car in this country is required to pass a test and get a license. They're all licensed. But there are plenty of really key drivers out there. It doesn't mean that they're going to drive better.
No, no. Having said that, if we scrap driving tests,
might get worse.
Worse.
That's true. Yeah, sorry, I didn't choose a very good analogy there. Never mind.
Anyway, on this one, I'm full square with the government.
Mm, yeah.
Well, they're full square with me because I got there first.
Yes, you did.
Right, so we're sorry we're a day late for anyone who cares about these things, and we hope you've enjoyed. Well, you're still with us, so you're obviously interested. Fantastic. But David, anyway, we'll be back at the usual time in 13 days' time, won't we?
Yes, indeed. Yes, on a Wednesday.
Brilliant. Alrighty. So thank you for listening once again from David and myself. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.